Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Do you know a local hero who you think we should invite on the air? Visit the You Produce page of our website and suggest a guest. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, the bottle and the can may say zero calories and carbs, but is diet soda actually any healthier than a can of sugared soda? Apparently not, or at least perhaps not, according to a new study published in Circulation, the American Heart Association's magazine, which found that daily consumption of diet soda at certain levels can increase the risk of what they call metabolic syndrome, which is sort of the underlying bodily changes that are believed to lead to heart disease or diabetes for so many people. Joining me this morning to talk about the study and the results is Dr. Ramachandran Vasan, the senior author of the study. And this is part of the big Framingham Heart Study, so anything found in this is presumed to have a high amount of credibility. He's a professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Vasan, thank you so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for having me.
What did you find? What didn't you find?
Right. What we found was that when we look at this middle-aged sample and follow them over a period of time, and we take people who do not have the metabolic syndrome, which you nicely described as you began this show, people who drank one or more soda a day had a 50% higher chance of developing this combination of risk factors called the metabolic syndrome compared to people who drank one or less soda per day. And it's interesting, as you pointed out, that it did not seem to make a difference whether the one or more soda per day was the regular soda or whether it was the diet soda.
Now, let me ask you about some of the pure science here, because as people with diabetes know, they are instructed to very closely monitor their sugar intake. They're not supposed to monitor their aspartame intake or any other artificial sweetener in the same way. In fact, that's supposed to be kind of diabetes friendly. And if you drink a diet soda artificially sweetened, your blood sugar level is not going to go up in the short term if you're a diabetic in the same way as if you drink a regular sugary soda. Is that correct?
That is correct, Brian.
So is your finding in this epidemiological study across populations with many things in people's lifestyles that it's hard to account for, is it even a scientific possibility, really?
Right. I think it's a scientific possibility for several reasons. And like you mentioned, what we describe here is an association. So I think we have to be very careful in making any inferences about causality over here, and we make none of those inferences. But it's possible one scientific explanation is the soda drinker himself or herself. We know that individuals who drink more of soft drinks have a dietary pattern that is characterized by intake of greater calories, more of saturated and trans fats, more of fiber, and a sedentary lifestyle. We adjusted for all these things in our analysis, but as you correctly point out, it's not always possible statistically to adjust for lifestyle. So one scientific explanation is that it's the soda drinker himself or herself.
It's the drinker, not the drink.
Right.
As one person I know put it, when offered a soda, she said, "I don't drink any of that. It's a fat magnet." And what she meant by that was, if you drink a sweet drink, then you're going to want to accompany it with something salty like chips or something fatty like meat.
Right. That's correct, Brian.
If you're drinking water or something else, then you're not going to have that that taste craving necessarily in the same way.
Right. That's correct, Brian. And that leads to the second set of explanations that, yes, it is a zero-calorie drink, but there are three things about this drink which sort of merit comment. One is that it's a liquid. And there's a dietary theory out there that if at a particular meal you were to drink more liquids compared to eating more solids, then at the next meal you tend to eat more because liquids have, you know, satiate you less. So that's one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The second possibility is that soda is sweet. Even if it's zero calorie, it's sweet. And there's a theory out there that if you drink more of sweet drinks, you may be conditioned for a greater dietary preference for taking more of sweetened items. And the third possibility is that we actually ask specific questions about cola, and we know that cola is brown, And that brown color is due to a substance called caramel. And when you give experimental animals caramel, they develop insulin resistance, which is a precursor of diabetes, and they develop inflammation in the tissues.
Really, from the coloring?
Right. So these are theories out there. So even if it's a zero-calorie drink, there are possibilities that it's a liquid, so it doesn't satiate you less.
Mm-hmm.
It's sweet, and therefore it could create a dietary preference for sweet items. And it's brown, and it may be the caramel. So a lot of things which could implicate it. But again, these are theories, and we are very circumspect in our conclusions and hope that nutritional scientists will help us understand better whether this association is related to the soda drinker or whether it's related to the soda.
Right. So you could do a further study and see if the same thing happens with people who drink diet ginger ale as opposed to diet cola, which doesn't have the coloring or whatever. And
right.
We can take a few phone calls on this, maybe since we know that diet sodas and particularly Diet Coke, which is the best-selling soft drink in America, are so prevalent in our culture. If you have some questions about this study for Dr. Vasan, the senior author of the study from the Boston University Medical School and the Framingham Heart Study, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let me ask you something about the Framingham Study in general. This is a big, multi-year, many people. Well, let's see. You tell me, how many people do you follow?
Right. The Framingham Study is following three generations of participants over the last 60 years. It began in 1948 with 5,200 people whom we call the original cohort, and about 300 of these individuals are alive today. But they contributed over the last 60 years enough information to help us identify high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes as important risk factors for heart disease. In 1971, the Framingham Heart Study enrolled a second cohort, which included the children of the original cohort and the spouses of those children, and we call this the offspring cohort. And we have followed this particular cohort, and this is a cohort that contributed information for the soda study now for about 37 years.
37 years?
Right. And in 2001, we were funded by the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute to recruit what we call a third-generation cohort, which is the grandchildren of the original cohort
mm-hmm.
and the children of the second generation.
This is
so
great.
We have 9,000 participants followed for anywhere from 7 to 60 years.
These are the great public health studies in America, this and a few others at this level. But how do you verify information about what people's diets really are? You say you could correct in this case for, you know, whether people really were eating more fat or more sugar or getting less exercise, all these other things. And so you kind of isolate to the diet soda by itself when you correct for all the other things based on people's responses. But don't people always report that they're living healthier than they really do?
That is correct, Brian. And that's a fundamental limitation of all observational studies. We try and account for these based on what we call as food frequency questionnaires that participants fill out. And we adjust for it to the extent it is possible. But clearly, one, there is always a bias in the way people recall things, and there's error in the way people recall things. That being said, I think that's a fundamental limitation of all observational studies. And that's true also of our research when we report, you know, other factors which are associated with heart disease and stroke.
Here's an email from a listener that says, I'm concerned about the information about artificial sweeteners being given on the show. I recently learned from a nutritionist that aspartame, Splenda, and saccharin, the artificial sweeteners, all have glycemic indexes as high or higher than table sugar. Thus, they are not safe for diabetics. Although they have few or no calories, they will still cause an insulin spike, blood sugar reaction, which is unhealthy for anyone, let alone diabetics. Could the doctor please comment?
Right. My response to that, Brian, is that I think I would defer to the nutritional experts. I have no personal expertise in talking about aspartame, Splenda, or its, you know, metabolic effects. I'm a cardiovascular epidemiologist and a cardiologist. So what we report here is clearly what we call in an epidemiological situation,
right,
guilt by association.
Right.
So I would defer to some of the experts who know more about aspartame,
right,
or Splenda.
Okay, and I was speaking, and I'm the one who made that statement, and I was speaking from my understanding, and I'm a journalist, certainly not a doctor or a nutritionist. My understanding is that diabetics are steered toward that if they're going to drink that kind of thing because of the sugar content. But perhaps my understanding is wrong. So I take that from the listener, and we'll try to clear that up. All right. People have questions. People have comments. Like Eddie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. I was just wondering about the caffeine content of diet soda. I mean, I know that they make caffeine-free.
Could caffeine be a factor in this metabolic syndrome?
That's a good point, Eddie. And actually, we did look at caffeinated and decaffeinated soda in our study. And we found that regardless of whether the soda was caffeinated or decaffeinated, the association with metabolic syndrome was consistent, suggesting that it's likely, more than likely, that it's not the caffeine component of the soda that's leading to this association we note. It's a nice point, Eddie.
Ed in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Was seltzer included in this study?
No. We asked about cola specifically, so some of the other beverages were not included in this study.
So you can't say anything about carbonation then as a possible factor, which a number of people are asking.
Right. I would not say anything about that.
Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Yes, hi. I've noticed that people who drink the diet products seem to drink it almost as an addiction. I've run across a lot of people who begin in the morning and drink it all through the day. And I was wondering if there was anything, any research on the addictive quality of diet sodas.
Right. Carol, that's an interesting point that you bring up. There is a theory out there which I mentioned at the beginning of this show, and it's hotly debated by the nutritional experts, which is why I call it a theory, is that when you drink more sweet drinks, you're conditioned towards developing a dietary preference for eating more of sweet things. And that's what happens in animal studies. When you feed them more sweet, they start craving for more sweet. So that's one potential mechanism which one could, you know, make an analogy with addiction. I wouldn't use that phrase personally, but clearly drinking more sweet, there is a theoretical possibility it creates a greater craving for sweet things, and greater craving for soda itself could be one of the mechanisms.
Kathy in Massapequa, you're on WNYC with Dr. Vasan. Hi.
Hi. One of the weaknesses of the original Framingham study was that it focused on men and not men and women. So I'm curious if these second and third generation studies look at men and women equally. The weakness of the first study, for example, missed that the symptoms of heart attacks in women are different than they are in men.
Kathy, I'm sorry to correct you, but the original Framingham study, when it began in 1948 with 5,200 men and women, and all three generations that we follow up for varying durations of time have men and women approximately in equal numbers. And I think one of the nice things about the Framingham study was way back in 1948, it took the lead by enrolling not only men but also women, which is why we've sort of published on risk factors for heart disease and stroke.
Was there some other big? There was some other big heart study that focused on men.
We had a physician's health study, health professional study that focused largely on male physicians. And there are other studies there which have focused exclusively on men, but the Framingham study has always included both men and women.
Helen in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Helen.
Hi there. There was a study a few years ago with rats where they gave the rats immunosuppressant drugs in apple juice, a drug in apple juice, for 10 or 12 days. After that, they gave apple juice alone, and it suppressed the immune system. Apparently, the hypothesis from this research was that there is an association in the brain. And it's possible that the association of sweetness, the taste of sweetness in the brain, causes the production of insulin, extra insulin, which causes the metabolic syndrome.
Have you heard this? Do you know that study?
Right. I haven't read the specific story that the study that Helen is quoting, but I've heard of this hypothesis that there are central mechanisms which mediate insulin release, and it's possible for drinks to modulate those central nervous system mechanisms and produce effects above and beyond the immediate content of the drink.
We just have about a half minute left, but this term metabolic syndrome, which a lot of people don't know, is seen as underlying both for diabetes and heart disease. What, in very short few words, is metabolic syndrome.
Right. The metabolic syndrome means having more fat around your belly and increased waistline, having high fasting blood sugar, having high blood pressure, and having high levels of fatty particles in blood, which we call as triglycerides, and they are risk factors for heart disease, and having low levels of the good cholesterol or the HDL cholesterol, which protects against heart disease. So these are the five components: high blood sugar, high blood pressure, abnormal lipids, and a waistline. And when you have three out of these five components, you meet the criteria for the metabolic syndrome. And because these are all risk factors for heart disease and stroke, it is no surprise that when you have the metabolic syndrome, you sort of double your risk of having a future heart attack or stroke.
Dr. Ramachandran Vasan, the senior author of the study from the Framingham Heart Study, published in the journal Circulation, on the association between diet soda and heart disease and diabetes. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.